May it please the court, Mr. Guy. First, I want to take the opportunity to reintroduce myself. My name is Luis Martinez, and I do have the privilege of representing Mr. Jones in this appeal. I do want to thank the court for allowing oral argument. I know that that is not something that always happens. I hope that I'll be able to answer your questions and be able to clear up any questions that you may have. Also, it's been a very strange year. This is my first Zoom appellate argument, and I will do my best to give everybody time so that I don't jump over and get in the way of the questions that you may have. Also, it's very nice to see Mr. Guy. He did practice in Victoria for a long time, and now he's up in Gregg County. It's good to see him. We had many cases together when he was here, and he can't get rid of me, and I can't get rid of him, apparently. I do want to start the argument in this case by talking about what the standards are here to a certain extent. I don't think that there really are any least restrictive standards that we can have when it comes to evaluating whether or not a judge should allow a self-defense instruction. And I think that bears starting to kind of set the frame of reference here for what is necessary for a judge in Texas to be obligated to give a self-defense instruction. We hear the words like weak, uncontradicted or contradicted, impeached or unimpeached, fact issues that require a quantum of evidence. These are perhaps some of the leanest requirements for evaluating anything. And then it's backed up by rules that tell the judge, but then you shall, then you must, then you are obligated. So I find that that's a little bit interesting that we have such least restrictive and then with most restrictive instruction to a judge in a trial court setting. You know, that we also have other things to consider, like coming from any source. And I think that's going to play a role, a very important role in determining from reading the state's brief in the case, how the court should rule in this particular case. Because as it appears to me, when we look at those restrictions, when we look at those guidelines, and when we look at what the obligations of a trial court judge are, I don't think there is another way to really evaluate this case. You know, it appears, and even in, I think one of the cases that was cited by the state in this case, Wright, and maybe I have the wrong Wright, but it was the a memorandum opinion issued. I think this court is already kind of doing what I would urge in this kind of case. And taking a, let's look at the big picture here when we look at the evidence, because it isn't, this is not a check, even though it may appear at first to be kind of a check the box kind of standard when we're reviewing this, that takes away from the ultimate foundation we have here is that these are fact issues that are to be applied in looking at this. And that requires looking at the record.
So Mr. Martinez, the trial court in this case specifically stated, from what I can understand from the record, that they believe that your client did not deserve a self-defense instruction because from the witnesses and it seems like he started the fight. So you can't start a fight and then claim self-defense. And because they were involved in a criminal activity, this was a drug deal that seemed to have gone bad, as a lot of drug deals do. So doesn't these type of actions that your client undertook, then he can't hide behind the self-defense charge? And the case law tells us that.
Well, I think what it also, yes, Your Honor, I agree that those are definite limitations on self-defense. And I don't want to talk around them, but in saying that, in conceding that they are limitations, that's limitations that can be determined by a jury. Those are indeed fact questions too, because I think also in looking at that kind of issue, or looking at your question a little more closely, Judge, what you have is the idea, and I think I cited that in my brief, that those are limitations that do not necessarily preclude the self-defense instruction. In other words, it's not for a Texas judge in a trial court room to say, you know what, I've decided that you don't meet that you can't surpass those limitations. I've decided that I'm going to take away that from the jury. Now, more specifically, in this case, I want to address why I don't think that those limitations would apply, because I think maybe that's probably your real question there.
Yes.
But I did want to at least kind of talk about that. And I will come back to it probably throughout the argument. But, you know, especially with the provocation, the provocation is not, you know, I think is one of the cases from the Court of Criminal Appeals said, you know, that the provoking the difficulty itself is an archaic term and it's a legal term of art. But when you end up with, you know, it's really more provoking the attack, but part of that provocation to meet why that should be given during a trial really comes down to, I think one of the last, I believe it's the last part of the provocation defense. And that's where a person is doing exactly what you're saying, where they're hiding behind some sort of pretext, if you will, for coming up to someone. And it's kind of like, you know, bringing a gun to a fight that you hope turns into an aggression against yourself, so that's your plan. And that's how I see provocation. Provocation requires that all of that be met as well, just like everything else. And I don't think this record, like I said, to be more specific, I don't think this record demonstrates that it was his plan to do for any of this to occur the way it did. And that assumes...
Well, that's one of the things that the state argues in their brief, is that there is, you know, there is, it is, I will agree with you, a very low standard, and we probably couldn't find a lower standard for a trial judge in order to give a self-defense. But the state is arguing here that there's no evidence at all as to your client's mental state that would lead to giving him the self-defense. I mean, we're just not supposed to just give it in every case. We have to, the trial judge had to have some evidence. So where is the evidence that he was entitled to self-defense? In other words, what you just argued, he wasn't provoking this fight. He wasn't going to hide behind this fight. There wasn't any evidence that would lead us for this trial judge to give a self-defense instruction.
Right. Well, I think, again, as I was saying, I think we're moving to how I would like the court to look at this case. Let's look at the big picture and what evidence was there, rather than, I think the state, for example, and if I'm not answering your question, Judge, please tell me, but I think the state in its argument is focusing on Mr. Jones not testifying. Whereas I say in response to that, let's look at the big picture here, especially when it comes to intent, because how do we prove intent in other kinds of cases? We prove it by the evidence around. For example, let's flip the argument and say that I was saying, well, they had no evidence of intent in a robbery case or something like that. And the state would probably answer to me, well, there was, let's say, just for hypothetical reasons, evidence of flight. Okay, that could be used. Let's look at what the person did with the car that they took. Did they leave it in a place where it would be found or not found easily? Those are all things that the state uses to show intent. You know, they use actions like, well, what was his intent to throw a punch, to do these? You know, we don't ever usually have the defendant ever saying, this is why I did it exactly, and this is how I did it exactly. Now, in a self-defense case like this, I understand why you might say, well, why don't you have to do both? Well, because we have the evidence in the record. we do know what was happening, what was being perceived. And ultimately, Judge, that would be the same as, for example, Sincere Parker, who was kind of giving us the play-by-play of what was happening. You know, she obviously thought that they were going to attack him. She thought that they were, she was relating what was occurring. You know, she said, yeah, I knew, he knew he was going to either have to fight or get hurt, you know, and I may be adding the, and get hurt, apologize. But she's relaying what she as a person is seeing. And the jury can do the same thing. They can take those reasonable inferences because they, the jury then has to look at it through his eyes. We would be proving this the same way if it were the other way around. We would be using that evidence. For example, you know, if they wanted to know if, you know, and I'm trying to use something that's not so related to this particular set of facts, just to highlight how broad that is, where we can't, the basic point here is that we can't just look at, well, was there a spoken word or a part of the record where it's spoken, he felt fear or he felt that he was being attacked or, well, we know those things. And this gets back to these low standards that we're talking about. Those things were said. Sincere Parker, her testimony was heard by this jury. The problem is by not giving the self-defense instruction, the jury was never allowed to determine for themselves whether they thought Mr. Jones was being reasonable or unreasonable in his response to it. You know, we don't have a situation, honorable judges, where we just have some guy that just came out and assaulted another person. There were circumstances, there was facts, and that's clear in all cases.
So address with us before you run out of time how the limitation of the criminal activity doesn't apply in this circumstance.
That wasn't related. I'll give it like this. I think even when a person is engaging in misdemeanor conduct or anything like that, that's a limitation. The jury can determine whether they believe that that criminal activity was related to the set of circumstances and fact. In case, or whether or not a person is limited in their ability to say self-defense. In other words, I don't think it's a presumption that because you engage in anything that might be criminal activity, that automatically that keeps you out, because you're going to end up with, you can end up with absurd results like that. For example, if someone is engaged in, let's say, a drug deal, okay? And let's say that after the drug deal is complete, an unrelated fight starts. Those two things aren't connected here. They're not. And if anything, it's still a question of fact as to what a jury is going to determine. And that's really the biggest harm here, is that Mr. Jones never got that opportunity. He never got a jury to say, hey, we think that you're engaging in, as alleged, whether he was a scheme to rob, whether it was a scheme to buy drugs, whether it was any of that, whether or not those two things are actually related. And I don't think we can get a presumption. And I don't think that a judge can take away that ability from a jury to be able to find those facts. You know, I think to answer your question maybe a little more summarily and really get down to it, is that people engage in all kinds of criminal activity all the time. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be, and may I have just maybe 10 more seconds to finish this thought?
Finish your thought, yes, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. You know, what it really comes down to is that those two things are not necessarily going to be related. And here what we have is if the testimony at trial is to be believed, Mr. Jones slapped another person, which would not be provocation or the criminal activity that gets to him being in a situation with two people coming after him. And whether or not those things are true, that's what's in the record. And I think that's why the judge should have granted the self-defense instruction.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Martinez. You'll have your 6 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Guy, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mr. Martinez. Well, it's good to be back in my old stomping grounds of the 13th Court of Appeals again.
It's good to see everybody's face.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Even my colleagues who I don't see anymore.
Now, the state's position in this case, we have two main arguments. First, that the defense wasn't entitled to a self-defense instruction at all. And then an alternative argument that even if they were entitled to an instruction and the court erred by denying that, that denial was harmless given the specific facts of this case. Addressing our first argument first, it's true that the burden to get a self-defense instruction is low, but there still has to be some evidence for a defendant to be entitled to it. And in this case, because deadly force was used, it's not enough for the defense just to put on some evidence that the appellant was afraid he was going to be attacked. There would instead need to be evidence showing that he was afraid that he was going to be attacked with unlawful force, and that he was afraid he was going to be attacked with deadly force. And
so, how do we get around trying to prove that type of evidence when the defendant is not testifying and doesn't, and you know, counterbalance the need of the defense not having to testify?
Well, Your Honor, there are a number of ways that could possibly come about. Certainly, if the defendant had said things out of court to other witnesses or had made an excited utterance during the incident itself, that would be one way. There could also be
testimony such as Ms. Parker and those other individuals who testified about how this was escalating, and they were showing how this would seem to be a very escalated right in front of them. Wasn't that enough testimony to show that there is at least the subjective evidence of that some reasonable person would be in fear of their life in this scenario?
No, Your Honor, because nothing in Ms. Parker's testimony would support the reasonable inference that either unlawful force or deadly force is being used. Ms. Parker described Mr. Brooks taking a swing at appellant after appellant had initiated a violent confrontation. And then she testified that 15 seconds later, the victim, Mr. Ramirez, took a swing at the appellant. So she's describing two attempts to strike him, separated in time by 15 seconds. There's no description from her as to where they were striking him. There's no indication from her that either of these men had weapons. There's no indication from her that either of them were unusually large men or substantially bigger than the appellant. There's no indication from her where on his body they were striking, that they were trying to strike repeatedly, that they were making threatening statements towards him, that they had a history of being excessively violent. There's just nothing from her testimony that would support by itself the conclusion either that their force was unlawful, quite the contrary. Her testimony suggests their use of force was in response to a robbery and thus would be lawful self-defense on their part. And there's certainly nothing from her testimony indicating that they were using deadly force. Again, quite the contrary. Mr. Hatley, the trial lawyer, tried to elicit a testimony from her that, you know, they were out to, and you know, I think the quote was whip his ass. And she specifically refuted that point and said no, that wasn't the case. She described them just as acting in defense of themselves. Now, if surrounding circumstances were developed, conceivably you could get there, but in the Wright case, for instance, where this court found that a self-defense instruction was properly denied, there were such surrounding circumstances. Victim in that case broke into the defendant's home. He was described in the record as being 6 foot tall, 205 pounds, so a large man. There were indications he was under the influence of narcotics at the time, and there were indications he advanced upon the defendant even after the defendant drew a weapon on him. All facts that could give a reasonable fact finder a basis to think that deadly force was going to be used. Likewise, the Carmen case out of the Houston First Court of Appeals that was cited in Wright. In that case, the victim had previously severely beaten the defendant, so there was a history there that had beaten him with enough force to put him in the hospital. In history, that would make it reasonable for the defendant in that case to fear that when this man was attacking him, that he was going to be using extreme force again. The Gilboa case, also cited in the Wright case, also from Houston. In that case, the victims threatened to give the defendant a beating of a lifetime. So there was explicit oral threats in that case that would give a fact finder reason to think that deadly force might have been used. But in this case, there's simply none of that. There was no evidence of a weapon, no evidence of threats, no evidence of a past history of excessive force, no evidence that this attack itself was carried out with any sort of extreme force. There's not even evidence the two of them were attacking this man at the same time. The evidence is that there was 15 seconds apart and that they were attacking in sequence, perhaps, but not simultaneously. There's certainly no evidence that either of these men were large or especially dangerous. Quite the contrary, the evidence about the victim, at least, showed that Mr. Ramirez was actually a very small man, weighing only at most about 137 and a half pounds at the time of this incident. So he's not a man who's just his size alone would logically cause the appellant to be in fear for his life. The inferences drawn from the evidence need to be rational. And on these facts, there's just nothing that would make it rational to conclude that this man believed he was under attack by deadly force. If we were to find—
You say there has to be a rational inference. I'm sorry, Mr. Guy. But is that the standard of review that we need to look at the evidence? Mr. Martinez starts his argument this morning about how it has to be, it's a very low burden, and you have agreed with that, and it can be weak. It doesn't have to be, it can be controverted evidence. And so are we supposed to look at it and say, well, okay, I don't believe that witness when he's, even if we had a witness said, oh yeah, I thought he was in fear of his life, and you know, I would have done the same thing just for the sake of hypothetically argument. But if I don't believe that witness as a trial judge, am I just not supposed to take all this evidence in the light most favored to the defendant to ascertain whether and not look at a reasonable inference? I'm trying to figure out how we look at this evidence in order to decide whether the trial court was correct in its denial.
Your Honor, I think the Court of Criminal Appeals gave us some guidance on that in the Shaw case, which is cited in the state's brief, and in that they said that courts must rely on common sense judgments as to the limits of rational inferences from the facts proven. So in that sense, I'd say it's probably similar to a sufficiency of the evidence analysis, where yes, you look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the defense, but the inferences still have to be rational from that evidence, and the fact finder is not free just to engage in rank speculation, because speculation just isn't competent evidence. And in this case, to conclude either that the appellate believed he was under attack by unlawful force or that he was under attack by deadly force would require rank speculation, because there's just nothing from the facts here that would support a rational inference from that evidence. If the evidence doesn't support that rational inference, then there's no basis for a self-defense instruction.
That's not just what the jury needs to look at, but what the trial court needs to ascertain. Because I think what Mr. Martinez is arguing is that the jury gets to decide whether their common sense to look at the evidence in a rational inference. But that's also the same standard that the trial needs to ascertain as whether to give that appropriate instruction?
Your Honor, the trial court still has a gatekeeping function to basically make sure that the jury is deciding even the self-defense issue on evidence. It's not necessarily the trial court's thing to weigh the credibility of the evidence when it's before it, but it needs to at least be possible that with a rational inference from the evidence, you could get to that point. And again, similar to a sufficiency of the evidence analysis, where the ultimate conclusion is you're going to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict, but the jury's not free just to engage in rank speculation to get to that verdict. And if they did, it would be insufficient evidence to support a conviction. That the jury's inferences still have to be based on something tangible, something real. And in this case, there just isn't anything real that would show either unlawful force or deadly force, or at least that the appellant believed he was under attack by either of those. The undisputed evidence at trial was that this was a robbery that the defendant provoked, that he initiated the confrontation. Even just the fact that he attacked these two people would go to disputing his fear of them using deadly force back at him. But the evidence was that any force they used was in response to an unlawful act he committed against them, which would negate any claim, any rational inference that he had a reasonable belief he was under attack by unlawful force. And just the complete lack of evidence as to the nature of how they attacked him, with there being no evidence of a weapon, no evidence of the attack being especially severe, no evidence of them being unusually large or otherwise especially dangerous, no history between these people, no evidence that the defendant believed that they had a history of violence. There's just nothing to point to that would get a rational fact finder to being able to conclude that appellate believed he was under attack by deadly force. And without either of those, without both of those prongs, he hasn't presented evidence to show he'd be entitled to a self-defense instruction, and thus he would not be entitled to a self-defense instruction.
Would that seem to be true under the criminal activity limitations?
Well, on the criminal activity limitation, I would largely agree with Mr. Martinez's position that if there's evidence of the defendant engaged in criminal activity itself might be a fact issue that might have to go to the jury as part of the self-defense instruction, because I don't think the defense necessarily conceded that he was committing the robbery. So the jury would still need to find that the robbery had occurred. But I do think that's especially a relevant consideration for the state's second argument, which is the fact that even if they were entitled to the self-defense instruction, the denial of it was harmless in this case. Now, so if I could segue into that, the Court of Criminal Appeals has, of course, said that typically in these type of cases, the denial of this type of instruction is harmful because basically a defendant is putting his neck on the chopping block when he admits to the underlying conduct or otherwise it doesn't really dispute it. He's basically kind of going all in on that, and which leaves him vulnerable if he's not allowed the defense that he's arguing for there. He's essentially admitted or at least not really contested the main allegations, and he's got no defense left. But in this case, that wasn't really the issue, because the defense did have a viable argument. In fact, I would contend it was the defense's main argument throughout this entire trial. And that was, yes, appellate struck Mr. Ramirez with the beer bottle, but he didn't have the required intent necessary to inflict death or serious bodily injury, that the result was an accident, that this wasn't the bad mental state wasn't there, and therefore he can't be guilty of murder under that basis. That was the argument the defense made in their opening. They developed that throughout the trial with the evidence that was presented. The argument that they went again with their close consistently, that was their primary argument in this case. And that also means that they wouldn't be unduly harmed by the denial of a self-defense instruction in the jury charge, because even without that, and with conceding that appellate did strike Mr. Ramirez, they still had a viable way to an acquittal. If the jury believed the argument that this was an accident, he wasn't intending the result of serious bodily injury or death, then the jury would have to acquit. Now, the other.
So you don't believe it was a harmful activity, even if the state in its closing argument, as argued by the defendant in this case, that was told, well, you can't consider self-defense, you can't consider that they were in this fight, that in itself doesn't create, if we even get to the harmful effect analysis, of course, that doesn't create a harmful analysis in this case?
No, Your Honor, because I don't think it undermines the defense's main theory of the case, which was an accident. And this is where, kind of referring back to your previous question, also why that'd be harmless is because even if the defense somehow just barely squeaked across the line to being able to be entitled to a self-defense instruction, the evidence for that instruction would still have been incredibly weak. The undisputed evidence at trial was that this was a robbery, which if the defendant is committing a robbery, he's not entitled to self-defense. The undisputed evidence was the defendant provoked the confrontation, started the fight, which again, that would, even if it doesn't automatically bar a defendant from a self-defense instruction, the fact that the evidence supports that and that the jury would know through a proper instruction that if the defendant started the fight, it's not reasonable for him to have used force. That would certainly go to how likely a self-defense instruction would have been successful. And in this case, since the evidence shows it was a robbery, the defendant provoked the confrontation, a self-defense instruction would not have been successful. And therefore there can't be harm from it being denied. By the same token, all the factors that support why the defense was not entitled to a self-defense instruction in the first place also support why the lack of that instruction would have been harmless in this case, just because the jury would have known if they'd received a self-defense instruction that the defense had to be able to show that they believed that they were under attack by unlawful deadly force. And in this case, there's simply nothing in the evidence that supports that. Even to get to that point would require the jury to speculate as to what the defendant was thinking after they'd already been told by the court that they were not supposed to make unbridled speculation. It's just not plausible on these facts that the jury would have believed a self-defense argument, even if they'd had that option. And the defense had a viable alternate theory, the theory that Mr. Hatley developed throughout the trial of accident. Therefore, there's good cause to find that the defense wasn't harmed by the absence of the self-defense instruction, even if they were entitled to it. And therefore, both because the defense was not entitled to this instruction in the first place and because they did not suffer any harm from its absence, the defense is not entitled to any relief and the verdict should stand. Does the court have any other questions for me?
I don't have anything. Justice Tejedina, Justice Longoria?
Nothing.
All right. Nothing. Thank you for giving us back a little bit more than 2 minutes, Mr. Guy. Mr. Martinez, whenever you're ready, you still have your full 6 minutes for rebuttal. And I'd like you to start with the Shaw case, as pointed out by Mr. Guy, as to how we're to look at this evidence of common sense and draw these rational inferences, and that we, in doing so, we can't draw a rational inference to give the defendant a self-instruction charge in this case.
I'm looking for their citation, Your Honor, if you give me just a second, and I'll
mic in. I don't have it in front of me either. I'd give it to you.
I have the case in front of me. I have the case, Judge. I'm just looking for where they cited that. 15, 16. Oh, okay. And I believe what the argument from the state, Your Honor, was that a court must rely on its own judgment formed in the light of its own common sense and experience.
Correct.
I think that's what you want me to address. Is that correct?
Because you're telling us that the inference is there and the trial court should have given it and the jury should have ultimately been able to make this idea. And he's saying, well, we're all looking at the same evidence. It's just how do we look at this evidence to decide whether we're going to get to that charge, that self-defense instruction?
Well, and I think to start, we kind of have to, I think you alluded to it in some of your questions to the state judge, where you were talking about the standards that apply here. If you look at, and I think this applies to your question on the Shaw case, what the state I think is trying to do, their argument is kind of making this a legal sufficiency argument in terms where we've already lost, okay? For example, when we look at the common sense and experience, most of the state's argument on the record in the case really focuses on how it could have been a better case for the defense to make the self-defense instruction. And I agree that that's important. But also I mean, I'm asking the court that I was asking the trial court, and I'm asking this honorable court to do the same thing. We're dealing with a set of rules that's telling us, yes, we evaluated. And I don't disagree. I cited Shaw as well. I don't disagree that we should use our common sense, but there's a difference between saying, I mean, like, was it, it appears to me that it is common sense for someone, if I'm hearing someone describe this to me, you know, we can argue all day long about whether these other guys were better fighters, were huge, where they were giants. And I don't mean to be flip about it, but they could have been NFL linebackers. That would just be an easier inference to make. But let's look at what the core inferences are here. There's a slap. There's a moment's hesitation. And if you look at in the record, Sincere Parker is describing, it took a second for Mr. Ramirez to realize, hey, this guy slapped me, which to me, common sense tells me, wasn't that big of a deal. But then we have immediately after that recognition, you get he gets his hands up and he looks like he's going to fight. That's exactly what is being seen and described by the witness who's watching it happen in real time. And that's her. I mean, if that's not common sense to think he raised his hands to look like he was going to fight, and that is indication of what was about to happen, that's common sense. Same thing, if there are two people who are attacking, and that's in there. I know that Ms. Parker says, now Mr. Brooks, the younger brother of Mr. Ramirez, the decedent, he says, well, no, I didn't do any of that. But the record does contain them saying, no, it looks like both of them are coming after him. That's common sense to me. That is not asking a judge to just throw it out the window and say, again, I'm not asking this court, and I'm not asking a trial court to tick a box, you know, but, and I obviously have to rely on their common sense, but there comes a point where we start deciding those issues without looking like we start deciding those issues by denying that instruction. You know, I think, again, I have to come back to the standards that we have here. You know, the standards are so low for when a trial court should give that.
So with your last 2 minutes, Ms. Martinez, I'm going to cut you off because we never got, assuming, and this court hasn't decided one way, we get past the instruction. How do we overcome the harmless analysis that needs to be done in this case?
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to address that as well. Thank you. First, I don't think that it requires, I mean, let's look at what the arguments of the state are. You know, even though at one point, when you get to the closing statements, particularly, the trial court has already denied the self-defense instruction. So there's not a whole bunch, and I don't think that the defense can be faulted, Mr. Jones can be faulted for not being able to argue that more vociferously, even though there were attempts to make that done. I know that the record demonstrates that. But here, it takes away an avenue. And at one point you have to look, and I think the standard is that it just has to be calculated to lead to the harm or against the benefit of the defendant. And I've misquoted that, I know. But that was horrible. But I think the court understands what I'm trying to say is that it just has to be calculated. Now, certainly, if he's entitled to the instruction, taking it away, what else could that be? I know that some recent cases talk about that. And, you know, and one of the things that the state relies upon to buttress that argument is that, well, it was evidence that could be also used for accident. Well, that's just as relevant to what Mr. Jones was doing that day, his actions again, you know, to not being a premeditated thing, to not moving along. You know, I think that it's harmful. It's harmful in the sense that, you know, that avenue's taken away from him and the state doesn't get to decide what or how the defense is going to defend the case. You know, The evidence that was raised that the state says, well, that's evidence of accident, is equally applicable to a self-defense claim. So I think if we allow the state to say, well, he's not been harmed because of it, well, the state doesn't get to do that. They don't get to tell us what our defense will be, how we will present it, and what instructions we'll ask for, you know, especially when we get denied the self-defense instruction and have to try and do something different or try and make that evidence work in different ways. You know, in listening to the state's argument, I didn't see anything that we couldn't shift, anything that couldn't be argued for accident or self-defense. So I think it obviously took away his avenue for acquittal, because even a self-defense instruction can be used against a murder case.
I'm going to cut you off, Ms. Martinez. Your time is up. This case will be under submission. Thank you very much for joining us. And you did very well for your first Zoom appellate argument.